So we come then to the final chapter of the book of Ezra. Seems to end rather abruptly, doesn't it? And a bit disappointing, I suppose. You've got this list of, the last 24 verses. It's just names. Now, I didn't read all the names because I know how difficult it is to get anything out of that, isn't it? What can you get from a list of names? Now, I think it's important to remember that actually Ezra Nehemiah in the Hebrew Bible is one book. So that, I mean, they're separate productions. But if you were taking a scroll of Ezra from the synagogue ruler, then you'd be given Ezra and Nehemiah together. So I suppose that should temper our thoughts. Ezra appears in Nehemiah, and perhaps in the near future we'll get round to looking at Nehemiah as well, although we'll take a break certainly at this point. Now let me remind you, Ezra then has returned to the Promised Land, returned to Jerusalem then with many others, and that was the second major return that the book of Ezra talks about. The first one occurs 57 years before the second one. And Ezra had begun then to teach the exiles the law of God. He was a teacher of the law of God. And it soon became apparent that there'd been a drift, really. It's just not a long time, 57 years. I'm 55, so I assure you, it's not a long time. But even in that relatively short time, they'd begun to drift away from their moorings. Despite their early enthusiasm, many of these returnees had wandered into error and into compromise. And the most striking thing was that a lot of them had entered into marriages with foreign wives and foreign husbands then. They'd married various Gentiles, non-Jews of different sorts. The holy race then had been mixed with the pagan peoples around them. And they were failing to keep themselves separate from their neighbors and from their detestable practices, even though that's what they've been commanded to do. And the focus of Ezra chapter 9 and chapter 10 is not simply on the sin and sin itself then, but on how it was dealt with. What was done to put the situation right. And that's what I want to try and deal with you this morning then. How to deal with sin when it arises in our own lives, when it arises in the life of a church or the life of a community. Now, as for the particular sin here, it was clearly wrong for a Jew to marry a Gentile, an unbeliever then. The purpose of God was to bring the Messiah into this world. Now, the Messiah had to belong to a particular race, he had to speak a certain language, and so on and so on. If that race then that God had chosen, the Jews who he'd chosen, if that race then is constantly mingled and mixed with other races, then it's going to create difficulties as you go along. And so the Jews, and not only for that reason either, but also because of the detestable practices of the pagans that lived around them, they were not allowed then to intermarry with the other peoples around them. Now, in a similar way, a Christian should never marry an unbeliever. It does happen, but a Christian should not marry an unbeliever. The 1689 Confession, for example, sums up the biblical position, I think, very well. It says, it is lawful for all sorts of people to marry, provided that they're able to give their rational consent. But it is the duty of Christians to marry only in the Lord. In consequence, those who profess the Christian faith should not contract marriages with infidels or idolaters. It is also quite unfitting for godly persons to become partners in marriage with persons who lead wicked lives or who maintain damnable heresies. So it's trying to cover the various sorts of unbeliever that you might come across. And I don't think it's saying, that two people can't get married if there's a slight doubt about whether one of them is a Christian. I don't think it's going that far. It's saying that a Christian ought to marry a Christian. A believer ought to marry a believer. We looked recently at the matter of divorce And we said then that there are differences between the New Testament and the Old Testament. And one of the differences that we see here is that whereas in Ezra's day then, the right way to deal with an unequal yoke, where you had a Jew and a pagan married to one another, was for there to be a divorce, and then well, that's the first thing, isn't it? That there had to be a divorce. You see, if you look in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, for example, Paul deals with this. You know, what if you do find that you're married to an unbeliever? Well, Paul says to the rest to say this, I not the Lord, he says. This isn't something that you'll find in Jesus' own teaching. But the Apostle Paul then, inspired by God, he says this. He says, if any brother has a wife who's not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who's not a believer and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. So that's the position under the New Testament. Then if you find yourself married for any reason to somebody who's not a believer, if they're willing to stay with you, stick with them. You should stay together. You shouldn't seek to get a divorce. If they insist on a divorce, there's not much you can do about it, of course. And you've not sinned if they insist on a divorce. But you should stay with them if they're willing. Now, in Ezra's day, it wasn't like that. The way to deal with it then was that the wives, the husbands then, were sent away, and the children as well, whether they wanted that or not. They had no choice in the matter. And I think the basic harshness of that can't be denied. I'm sure everything was done to lighten it and to make it easier, but it was a harsh and a hard thing, whereas in the New Testament things are dealt with in a much more tender, a much more hopeful way. And there is that difference, I think we have to acknowledge. Having said that, we need to come back then to this matter of how to deal with sin when it does arise. Jesus says, doesn't he? He says, sins are bound to come. The fact is that we must be very clear on how to deal with those sins when they do arise. Now, last week we talked about how to say sorry, how to confess our sins. That's really what chapter 9 is about, isn't it? You see Ezra there confessing sins. They weren't his own personal sins. They were sins that had been committed in the community in which he lived. And so he felt responsible, and we all ought to feel responsible then. If one of us in this congregation sins, if somebody in this community sins, then we ought to feel concerned and we ought to go to God to confess those sins. And when we ourselves have sinned against people, we ought to pray for mercy and forgiveness as well. That's vital. But there's more then. And so this week I want us to look at a number of important principles that will help us in this area. I've used the letter C for all of them. Some of you like to follow the sheet. I do it for children and youngsters, but I know others of you like to use it, so you're welcome. So first of all then, we'll talk about commands. God's commands are to be respected. That's the first thing. God's commands are not to be forgotten or ignored. They are to be remembered and respected. We must obey them, and when we fail to do that, then something must be done about it. We can't say, well, everybody sins, so there you go. That's the way it is. We can't take that attitude. God commands separation from the world, and that brings certain demands with it. Our text for this year, you'll remember, trouble is familiarity breeds contempt, doesn't it? So you probably don't even read it now, but it is there on the front of the sheet. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. 1 John chapter 2. And verse 15. If you profess to be a Christian, then you cannot forget that. You have to be separate from the world. And the same goes then for all God's commands. And sometimes it seems we pay more attention to what men have to say than to what God has to say. And that should never be the case. Think of the coming judgment. I think our motto should be the one that's found if you look at the end of verse 3, back in Ezra now, Ezra 10, and towards the end of verse 3, Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the descendants of Elam, he says to Ezra, he says, let it be done according to the law. Let it be done according to the law. That ought to be our attitude. So commands, first of all. God's commands are to be respected. And then secondly, the word counsel. Counsel. It's often good, I think, to consult with others on how to deal with sin. You know, sometimes, I mean, not always, sometimes it's very clear what we need to do because we've sinned. But sometimes we're not entirely sure how we go about it, and it's good to consult. So we don't want to say that, although we're focusing on what God says, not on what men say, we don't want to then go to the extreme and say, well, we don't even think about what men say. We do consult. And we seek the counsel of others. And so in verse 3, this man Shechaniah, then son of Jehiel, he says to Ezra, he says that the covenant that was proposed here, and which we'll mention the covenant in a moment, he says it should be employed in accordance with the counsel of my Lord and of those who fear the commands of our God. So when it comes to dealing with sin then, when it comes to practicalities, we need the counsel of holy men, and we ought to seek that. It's very easy to become complacent about sin in our lives. But we hear a sermon, don't we? Or we read a book, perhaps, or somebody speaks in conversation about a particular sin, and we become aware of it. And we think, this can't go on. Perhaps you're thinking this now. Perhaps there's some particular sin in your life, and it's the very fact we're talking about this, it's brought it to mind. And you see, if that is the case, something must be done, isn't it? Something must be done about it. And that's what happened here then. They were quite complacent at one point. But then Ezra came, and he spoke to them in this very stern way that he spoke. And he then went on to talk to them about how to practically deal with the situation. So, yeah, practical things. I looked up a website the other day, a WikiHow thing, okay? How to deal with temptation then, which is the other end of dealing with sin, prevention rather than cure. Now, I don't think this was written by somebody I'd agree with on everything theologically and so on, but I think it was helpful. I mean, the basic thing, there were four things. One, avoid situations and people that lead to sin. I mean, that's basic, isn't it? If you're going to avoid sinning, you need to keep away from certain people. You need to keep away from certain situations. You need to realize that. Secondly, then, get help. Get help. You don't need to fight your temptations alone. There's some particular sin that you're struggling with, and you're struggling, and you're struggling, you're getting nowhere with it. You need some help. It's not a defeat in and of itself, then, to have to turn to somebody and ask for some help. Thirdly, occupy yourself. There is truth to the old saying, idle hands are the devil's playthings. Sometimes we're falling into sins because we're just not filling our time with better things. We're idling away our time. And then the fourth thing here is to be persistent. Temptation, unfortunately, doesn't just go away when you choose to resist it. Sometimes we get ourselves involved in a real fight. So those are practical things, aren't they? And I just found out on a website. I just put in to Google, isn't it, temptation, how practical ways of dealing with it. And there were lots of other things on that site that were helpful as well. And there is a lot of help that is to be had then from consulting, from seeking good counsel. Not all counsel is good, but good counsel then. Especially with regard to dealing with sin. So God's commands then, they're to be respected. Counsel then, it's often good to consult with others on how to deal with sin. Covenant. Now covenant is an important word here then. A solemn agreement about how to deal with sin can often be a help. You see, the very practical way things are dealt with here is by means of a covenant. It's this man Shechaniah then who says to Ezra, he says, we've been unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women from the peoples around us. But in spite of this, there's still hope for Israel. It's great when somebody says that, isn't it? I don't know if you've been in that situation. You say, well, I've really sinned. I've really messed up. And then somebody says to you, well, there's still hope. There's still hope. And that's the way this man Shechaniah speaks to him. But in spite of this, he says, there is still hope for Israel. Now, he says, Let us make a covenant. We know from the Children's Catechism, I trust, that a covenant is an agreement between two or more persons. So he says, let's make a covenant before our God to send away all these women and their children. So a solemn agreement then was proposed as a practical means of doing something about sin. Now I think this is where we often fall down, is it in the practical area. We sin, we don't like the fact that we sin, we agree that we need to stop doing it, we need to get rid of it, but then we sort of putter out there, don't we? We don't sort of get to the, well, how are you going to go about it? How are you going to do it? And this is where the sort of Christian counselling movement is, it can be a great help. It's not always a help, but I think it can be a great help because it's very good at giving you homework, very good at setting out for you. Well, look, you've got to do this, you've got to do that in order to deal with sin. So we need then to... lost my place for a moment. Yes, thinking about hearing sermons, reading books again. So we hear a sermon. We read a book, we're sorry then, we seek forgiveness, but we don't really take it any further than that. We don't make any concrete plans on how to bring sin to an end. Now, as hard as it must have been for these people, nevertheless, they're willing to take the drastic step of putting away their wives and their husbands, if that's the case. This is the gouging out of the right eye, the cutting off of the right hand that Jesus speaks about in the New Testament. And to steel themselves then to this demanding work, the Jews didn't just make some sort of vague promise. They didn't say, you're right, Ezra, we really need to get this sorted out. We'll deal with it. They didn't do that. No, they bound themselves by covenant oaths. And that's the sort of approach, I think, that we need towards sin. I suppose it doesn't matter quite whether you formally make a covenant or how you make a covenant, but what matters is that sin is actually dealt with. There must be then at the very least a solemn promise, not just a vague promise. Yeah, I really need to get this sorted out. I mean, a solemn promise before God that this is going to be sorted out. You remember Job? It's interesting what Job says is when Job is describing the godly life that he lived in the past, he says, Job had a problem that if he saw a pretty girl, perhaps some of you have this problem, when he saw a pretty girl, he would not only look and say, oh, thank the Lord for a pretty girl, but in his mind would go further. And so to stop him doing that, he made a covenant. Some of you know this verse, he made a covenant with his eyes. He made an agreement with his eyes that whenever he got himself in that situation, he would make sure he looked away. He didn't look again. He didn't look so that he would lust after that particular girl. And you may want to make a covenant then with your eyes. You may want to make a covenant with a friend. Whatever happens, there needs to be a solemn and a steely, a practical plan in order then to be done with sin. That's the way we've got to go about it. So that's the third thing. We're working our way through these C's, aren't they? C for commands, God's commands, to be respected, counsel, often good to consult, covenant, solemn agreement. And then fourthly, we come to community. So community sin needs to be dealt with then on a communal basis. I think that's probably the outstanding thing in this chapter, isn't it? Is the way that they worked on this together. It was a community effort. Shechaniah urges Ezra to take the lead. He says, rise up, he says, verse 4 is there. Rise up, this matter is in your hands, he says. But he adds then, we will support you. So, take courage and do it. So having discovered this grievous sin in their community, they didn't attempt to deal with it as individuals then. They didn't say, well, those of you who have sinned in this way, you've got to get it sorted out. No. They dealt with it together. They worked together and they helped each other over this hurdle. And that reflects the mood then all the way through the book of Ezra, and it comes out, doesn't it, in Ezra's prayer as well. And it's very much something that's encouraged in the New Testament. You know, we're under an obligation, aren't we, as Christians? Not just to look to our own interests, but to look to the interests of others. We have a duty to rebuke one another. I think it came up in one of those Proverbs that we read, isn't it? And it's very hard, isn't it? You see something wrong in somebody's life, you know, I shouldn't be doing that. That's not good. And the easiest thing to do is to talk to somebody else about it, isn't it? You say, "Oh, have you seen what they're doing? Terrible." Really, you ought to be going to that person. I know it's very difficult to do that. And say, "Well, look, this is not right. You shouldn't be doing this." Now, sometimes they'll just, you know, be upset and they won't listen to you. Sometimes they'll be upset and then they'll listen to you a little bit later when they've calmed down. And sometimes it's like that. And we try and avoid upsetting people needlessly. But we have a duty to rebuke one another. And those who are spiritual then are to gently restore those who are caught in a sin. James reminds us that if anyone wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, that person is saved from death and from a multitude of sins. How we go about all this, of course, is set out for us in Matthew chapter 18. You know Matthew chapter 18, where it talks about the sheep that's wandered away and all the efforts that are made to bring the sheep back and all those things about speaking. One person speaks. If they don't listen, two people speak. If they won't listen to two people speaking, then it's a matter of bringing to the church and so on. All those things are set out for us in the New Testament, and we don't have to look at that now. But we need to be aware of that. So that's the fourth thing then. And then the fifth thing is courage. I'm sure you noticed that word there, courage. Well, without this, you're not going to be able to deal with sin as you ought to. It's there in Shechaniah's phrase as well, isn't it? Verse 4, "We will support you," he says. So take courage and do it. And that's important then, isn't it? Sin slaying is not for the faint-hearted. It calls for great courage. To oppose sin, you see, if you're opposing sin, you're going against your natural inclinations. You're going against what the whole world believes in and supports. You're going against what, it's not a struggle against flesh and blood, is it? But with principalities and with powers then, with spiritual forces of evil. That's one of the reasons why it's so difficult sometimes. Unless we are bold and confident in God, then we're not going to be able to get anywhere. If you bruise your thumb or your finger, you know, it goes black and sometimes you've got a situation, there's a build-up of blood underneath. And you need to get the nail off. I don't know how it myself. My father told me a story once about a man he knew, and he had that situation. He had this blood under his nail, and he knew the nail had to come off. And so he was in a workshop, and so he went to this, there's a press drill. He put his finger on the press drill, like that, and he just did it far enough so that the nail came off, and the pressure was relieved. That sounds like a brave man to me. If he'd done it wrong, I suppose he was a foolhardy man. But it took some bravery. It took some courage, didn't it, to do that. But that's what needed to be done. Now, in our situations then, it takes some courage. It takes skill, but it takes courage as well to act in the right way. And we need to be ready to act bravely and decisively in order to deal with sin. That's the bit I feel worst about. You know, when you preach a sermon, you have to do it, if you do it properly, you have to preach it to yourself first, and then you preach it to everybody else. That's the one, isn't it? I'm a chicken. I'm a real coward. I really, to deal with sin. But it does, it takes courage, doesn't it? We've got to ask God to give us strength. Give us courage. And then seventh, cessation. No. Oh, I've got a conflict here. Six. We've missed six. Commitment. We need to be committed. Number six, isn't it, to dealing with sin. That's another element. If you look at verse 5, we read Ezra rose up there and he put the leading priests and Levites and all Israel under oath to do what had been suggested, and they took the oath. This covenant idea then wasn't just an idea. Ezra acted on it. And the people acted on it, and they were decisive about it. They committed themselves to their commitment, we might put it that way. And there must always be not only a resolve to do something about sin, but a steely resolve to see it through. You've got to see it through. And often that's where we fall down then. If we really want to deal with sin, then we need to be resolved. You know, in sport, they often speak about a killer instinct, isn't it? You have to have a killer instinct if you're going to win the game, if you're going to win the match. Well, in a similar way then, we need to have that sort of instinct towards sin. Are you committed then in your opposition to sin, as these people clearly were? That ought to be the case. And then cessation comes next, doesn't it? Cessation to deal with sin. We have to actually stop sinning. Now that might seem so obvious to say. And yet isn't this the problem, that there are sins in our lives? Perhaps in the life of the church, I don't know. Where we say, well, we'll do something about that really, but we don't actually do anything about it. And we need to stop sinning then, because without that, all our sorrow, all our covenanting, all our commitment is just hot air. It's nothing. And it's essential then that we actually stop. We bought a new car recently, new to us anyway, but so it's not a brand new car, but it's a new car. Now, one of the odd things about this car, it's a Honda FRV, if you're interested in all that sort of thing. The handbrake is a bit different. It's you know, normally on a car, isn't it? Your handbrake's down here, and you pull it up, and you stop, and so on. But this one, it's on the dashboard, so the wheel's here, and then you sort of you press this button, and it releases. So it comes in and out like that. And it's taken a little bit of getting used to, but it's not that strange. It's just a little bit different. And I suppose there must be lots of different handbrake styles in different cars and so on. I remember my parents had a car, and the handbrake was on the right on the other side, on that side, rather than on the left-hand side. I don't know quite why that was, but that was where it was designed. Now, in the end, it doesn't really matter what the design of the handbrake is. As long as it stops the car from rolling down the hill, who's bothered? Who's bothered about the actual design of the thing, how it looks? The important thing is that it works and it stops the car from rolling down the hill. And it's the same with anything, isn't it? Some medicines taste really pretty awful, don't they? They're not very nice at all. But if it stops the illness, if it brings that to an end, well, you just have to live with it. You just take it. And so, in a similar way, what we need to do is to stop sinning. That's the essential thing. If all that we've been talking about, commands and counsel and covenant and commitment, if it all doesn't lead to us actually stopping the sin coming to an end, well, it's useless, isn't it? It's got to stop. And then with stopping, we've got continuing as well. So cessation and continuing. There is a continuation, because we must go on mourning for sin and confessing sin. I'm not suggesting that mourning for sin and confessing for sin is unimportant. It is important. We ought to confess and mourn and go on doing that. Verse 6, Ezra withdrew from before the house of God then. He went to the room of Jehohanan and the son of Eliashib. And while he was there then, he ate no food, he drank no water, because he continued to mourn over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. He continued to mourn. So he wasn't saying, oh, well, we're going to deal with it now, that's great, let's forget about it. No. He continued to mourn over it. And so, although we need to be practical and we need to stop sinning, there ought to be mourning as well. We mustn't lose our sense of horror at sin. I'm sure I've mentioned to you before examples you can find of ministers then who've fallen into serious sin. And they've been found out, and then they've confessed their sin, they've said sorry, and then they've begun to produce books and seminars on how to repent from serious sin. I'm really not sure about that. I don't think that's... I think if a minister has sinned grievously, he's had to leave the ministry, well, it's best that he just keeps quiet in a corner. I know a man who started in the ministry and fell into what seemed to be a serious sin. He resigned. He's just lived out his life very quietly. He's done what he can in the Lord's service. And I think that's the way you've got to go. I think pride is so... It's so easy for pride to sneak in, isn't it? So it's important then that that we continue to mourn for sin. We continue to confess it. I'm not saying that we don't believe there is a forgiveness for sin, isn't it? But you know, if you fall into some serious sin, and then God forgives you for that, and you don't do that again, you're forgiven for that sin, but you're going to be sorry that you ever did that sin, always, aren't you? You're not going to say, oh, well, there you go, I got over that. You're going to be sorry for that sin. And there ought to be that continuous mourning and sorrow. Two more things then, common sense. And common sense is always important, isn't it? Now, let me explain to you what common sense means. People say, why is common sense so uncommon? And they think they've made a very funny remark there. Common sense means all your senses working in common. All your senses working together so that you do the sensible thing. You make a sound judgment. And I'm mentioning it here because you can see that the people use their common sense here in Ezra chapter 10. This was a terrible sin. It affected the whole community. And so it was right that they should gather together in Jerusalem to deal with it. And so we read in verse 7 that a proclamation was issued throughout Judah and Jerusalem for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem. If anybody had failed to appear, then there was a severe judgment on them. They would be expelled from the assembly of the exiles. And so within 3 days, which doesn't, you know, for us that sounds not particularly remarkable, but you think of how people were traveling in those days. And in 3 days they managed then to get representatives from all the men of Judah, all the men of Benjamin, and they came and they gathered there in Jerusalem. And it was a very distressing occasion, as you can imagine. And what added to it was the winter weather. On the 20th day it was of the 9th month, all the people were sitting in the square then that was before the house of God. And they were greatly distressed, well, it says, by the occasion and because of the rain. It was raining at that time. They were getting soaked while they were there. And Ezra brought the charges before them then, verse 10 and 11, you've been unfaithful, you've married foreign women, adding to Israel's guilt. Now honor the Lord, the God of your ancestors, and do his will. Separate yourselves from the peoples around you and from your foreign wives. And they reply then, and I think there's a lot of sense, isn't there, in their reply. They say, you are right, we must do as you say. But there are many people here, and it's the rainy season. We're getting soaked out here, Ezra. I don't think Ezra was the sort of man who didn't even notice it was raining. You know, I think that's the way he was. But they could see, they were all getting soaking wet there. And they were saying they couldn't stand outside any longer. Besides, they said, this matter cannot be dealt with in a day or two, because we've sinned greatly in this thing. So let our officials act for the whole assembly, and let everyone in our towns who's married a foreign woman come at a set time, along with elders and judges of each town, until the fierce anger of our God in this matter is turned away from us. You see, they could see it couldn't be dealt with just in a day. And so what they did was they tried to systematically and very carefully do what Ezra had commanded them to do over the coming weeks. They were very organized, weren't they? Verses 16 and 17, Ezra the priest selected men who were family heads, one from each family division. They were all designated them by name. First day of the 10th month, they sat down to investigate the cases. So that's what they do. I mean, I think that's what that illustration is supposed to show. I always like to put a little picture on the front. I think that's what's going on there, isn't it? That's an investigation. Whether it was quite like that, I don't know. But something like that, isn't it? So they called the people in, they investigated, they found out. And by the first day of the first month, they finished dealing with all the men who'd married foreign women. Now, we need common sense to deal with our sins. Some sins won't disappear overnight. Some sins will never be stopped without radical changes. We need to make radical changes to our lives in some cases. We need to recognize, you know, we've all got different temperaments, haven't we? We've got different situations. And so it's no wonder that some of us run into certain sins. We ought to know, you need to watch yourself. When you're tired, have you not noticed this? That when you're tired, then you're more susceptible to certain sins than others. Well, if you're unwell, or if it's, I don't know, certain times, you know, you're perhaps in the winter, you're not the same as you are in the summer. You need to think about it, look at it, and use your common sense. Some sins only remain because we're just not organized enough to deal with it. We just lead sort of rather sloppy lives, and it's no wonder we keep sinning. And we need to get ourselves organized so that we don't fall into those sins ever again. Common sense, very important. One more thing then. I know this is 10 is a bit cheeky. My wife once told me never say that I've got 10 points because they won't listen. But you can see I've got 10 points because they're on here, aren't they? So I've had no choice this morning. But just one more thing. And this is, I suppose, is the most important. And we mustn't forget this, is it? The cross of Christ. The cross of Christ. It would be easy to miss this, actually, because by the time you've got to verse, 17? You've got the basic idea, and then all you've got to do is read through those names then at the end. And you might say, well, I won't bother to read those names. But if you just ignored those final verses, you'd miss verse 19. Verse 19, they all gave their hands in pledge to put away their wives, and for their guilt, they each presented a ram from the flock as a guilt offering. Now, it's in brackets here, isn't it? So it doesn't look like a very important thing. And I suppose it's not mentioned until this point, and only in connection with this particular group of people, although I'm sure it applied to all the groups of people, but it's just mentioned the once. And I think the reason for that is because it would be so obvious to the Jews to do this. Of course there would be sacrifices. That there were bound to be sacrifices. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 22. Sacrifice was vital if there was going to be real forgiveness and renewed harmony with the Lord. And still today, blood is necessary. I hope you know that. You can't find any forgiveness for your sins without the blood. You need the blood of Christ. The blood of goats and rams can't remove sin permanently, of course. They're only symbolic acts. But the blood of Jesus Christ, that's enough. That's why he died. That's what we had a class this morning, bite-sized theology, on this very subject. That's why he died. You know the hymn, don't you? He died that we might be forgiven. He died that we might be forgiven. He died to make us good. He died that we might go at last to heaven, saved by his precious blood. That's how, isn't it? By his precious blood. And that's why we must all turn to him and trust in him. He alone. No, but I can't forgive your sins. And you can't forgive my sins. Only Christ. Only Christ.